observer is human. He can be corrupted. He could be a drunk.
Congress debates whether to require observers on fishing vessels. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, March 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Iditarod champion talks about his strategy.
The main key about the whole Iditarod is the run-rest ratio. Run enough to be in position and rest enough to keep your speed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
The latest rewrite of a bill cutting taxes on oil companies is expected to cost the state more than $1 billion next year. That is more than any version that's been introduced so far. The Senate Finance Committee offered their adjustments to Governor Sean Parnell's oil tax bill on Tuesday, and the Department of Revenue weighed in on how it would affect revenue this morning. Under current production forecasts, the new plan would cut taxes on oil companies by up to $1.3 billion next year. The analysis goes out 6 years, and during that time, the total tax break would fall somewhere between $7 and $10 billion. For comparison, the governor's bill is projected to cut taxes by $5 billion over that same period. Senator Lyman Hoffman, a Bethel Democrat who serves on the Finance Committee, calls those numbers truly staggering.
To move this much cash across the table is going to have... In my view, detrimental effects to the state's operating budget.
Representatives from the Department of Revenue say their analysis is preliminary and does not consider how the bill would change levels of oil production. Right now, the state levies a variety of taxes on oil, including a profits tax that goes up with the price per barrel of oil. All versions of the oil tax bill that have been considered scrap that element of progressivity. The governor's original proposal would have oil taxed at a flat rate of 25%, while the finance rewrite ups the base tax to 30%, but offsets that with a $5 per barrel credit. Joe Balash is a deputy commissioner with the Department of Natural Resources, and he says the administration will be working with the Finance Committee to tighten the revenue projections.
We're anxious about that, but you know, the Senate appears to be trying to find its own happy balance.
Balash adds that he's happy to see that the Senate hasn't reintroduced any sort of progressive mechanism to the bill. The Senate Finance Committee will continue to review the bill this week. The Magnuson-Stevens Act, the federal law that manages and regulates the nation's fisheries, will expire on September 30th. Today, a U.S. House committee formally started the reauthorization process, and as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, changes could be on the horizon for how the government monitors fisheries.
The Magnuson-Stevens Act has been law for more than 30 years. It was last amended in 2006. It's put an end to foreign fishermen legally harvesting seafood in American waters, and it's stabilized many fisheries by enforcing catch limits. No member of the House Natural Resources Committee present this morning indicated they'd let the program expire, and everyone who testified said it should be continued, though with some changes. Commercial fishermen and industry representatives complained about the requirement to have human observers on vessels, recording the size of the catch and bycatch.
If they were allowed to use less high-tech methods and cheaper methods, they could survive.
That's Bob Dooley, president of United Catcher Boats. His company fishes the West Coast and throughout Alaska. He says the captain is responsible for covering the cost of an observer, and it's prohibitively expensive.
It's north of $900 a day right now, approaching $1,000, for the government to provide an observer.
That number could neither be verified nor applied to the various fisheries in the state. It took many by surprise, including NOAA's Sam Rauch. He says NOAA is concerned about the cost of observers and is interested in pursuing cameras in their place, but there are issues.
A technological issue. What can the cameras tell you now They're very good at the moment of identifying discard events. Did somebody throw something overboard? They're not yet to the point where they can identify individual fish.
On top of that, NOAA would have to adapt regulatory requirements to include the cameras. Congressman Don Young, an original author of the Magnuson-Stevens Act, says the observer program was not part of the original bill.
It was put on because we wanted some better data for NOAA to make decisions on the quota. And I'm saying, let's go beyond the mule skinner now and get into the computer age.
Young says he's considering writing a provision into the reauthorization that would allow commercial fishermen to use newer technologies to monitor the catch.
The observer is probably the worst thing that can happen to the sustainable yield rationalization. Because the observer is human. He can be corrupted. He could be put into the trawl net, solve some problems. He could be a drunk.
The act is set to expire September 30th, leaving Congress plenty of time to debate the measure. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell announced yesterday a $200,000 multi-year study of Arctic marine shipping. He told a meeting of the Arctic parliamentarians in Washington, D.C., the project will be conducted by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The State Department of Commerce will pay for the research. Treadwell says the state needs to understand safe, navigable routes to allow for increased economic activity in the region.
We want to understand how can shipping with all these cargoes going past help reduce the cost of power or cost of energy for people who live in Western Alaska. We want to understand how we can make our resources more competitive, whether it's Red Dog or other proposed projects in the north and the west.
A University of California geographer released a study last week that shows Arctic shipping could be possible for unescorted open water vessels by mid-century. Lawrence Smith modeled Arctic shipping routes using climate change models and navigation rules. The results show that by 2040, light icebreakers will be able to go pretty much anywhere in the Arctic Ocean during the late summer melt season, including straight over the North Pole.
And open water vessels are able to definitely cross through the Northern Sea Route over Russia and increasingly through the Northwest Passage as well.
Right now, there's almost no commercial shipping through the Northwest Passage, and vessels transiting the Northern Sea Route need an icebreaker escort. But both routes cut thousands of miles off the standard journeys through the Suez or Panama canals, and the ability to travel unescorted could make them increasingly attractive to shippers. Smith says that should concern policymakers in the region.
The Arctic is a very remote place. Very dangerous place, always will be. The ice will always come back in winter. It's dark, the charts are poor, and ordinary open water ships make up the vast majority of the ships on Earth.
And the day when open water vessels can make the journey may be coming even sooner than Smith's models predict. The climate change models he used assume incremental change between now and 2040. But Smith says the rate of sea ice decline is happening faster than even the most aggressive models show, so his calculations should be considered conservative. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Fairbanks pioneer Ginny Wood, who tended her own garden well into her 90s.
I would look out in the garden first. Often she would be on her hands and knees, turning the entire garden with a hand trowel.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
More than 20 Iditarod teams have crossed under Nome's Burled Arch. This year was one of the most competitive and closest races in Iditarod history. KYC's Emily Schwing caught up with this year's top three finishers and has the story.
A crowd in Nome cheered as 53-year-old Mitch Seavey drove his 10-dog team under the burled arch to become the Iditarod's oldest champion. Seavey made a tough final push to Nome from White Mountain, with Allie Zirkle chasing close behind.
I hate to do that to Allie, but, you know, there's only room for one winner this year, so it had to be me.
This is Seavey's 18th finish and second win. He says he was pleased with how he ran his dogs in the first half of the race.
The main key about the whole Iditarod is the run-rest ratio. Run enough to be in position and rest enough to keep your speed. And I think I did a pretty good job of that in the early part of the race.
But Seavey fretted over the amount of rest his team had had as they got closer and closer to Nome.
I tried to make a couple of big jumps and it took away my speed. And so then you get in the wrong kind of a cycle where you can't rest enough to get your speed back without losing out on a top position. So you get stuck back in the crawling mode, having turtle races out there.
Many teams spent most of the 936-mile race leapfrogging each other. Second-place finisher Allie Zirkle pulled into Nome less than an hour behind Seavey as the crowd chanted her name. Zirkle worked her way up to second in the last few runs, but was unable to finally catch the team in front. This is the second time in as many years that Zirkle has finished in second place. It's also her second loss to a Seavey. Last year, she trailed Mitch Seavey's son, Dallas, coming into Nome. The Two Rivers musher took a deep breath as she checked in her gear and gave her final signature to race officials.
Yeah, I'm glad to be done for sure.
Zirkle had a frustrating run into Nome. At times, both she and Mitch Seavey could see each other on the trail. But Zirkle's leader, Quito, who ran the entire race up front, just wasn't feeling up to the chase.
So right, she just got a bellyache, Quito.
Oh, she had a bellyache?
She did and I did.
All right.
She wouldn't lope at all today.
An hour and a half after Zirkle's team had left the finish chute, a delighted Jeff King pulled his team across the finish line. The four-time champion and 23-time finisher from Healy walked up the line greeting each of his dogs on the way. When he got to his leader, Skeeter, he laid down, lifted the dog on his chest, and took a deep breath.
Come here. Come here, Skeeter. Come here.
King says he's very proud of his team.
This team is here in spite of me. I made a couple of really big mistakes. You never really know until you have things play out a little bit. But in retrospect, I did a couple things that I really wished I hadn't. But I can't complain. An awesome finish with an awesome team and great competitors.
King made a big move out of Koyuk to take the lead late in the race, but a soft trail and the hot sun worked against him.
It takes a lot of confidence. The dogs need to know that you're on their side and that you're in this together. And it was getting just so difficult to travel after such a long run from Unaclea, basically such a long run that we just stopped until they had the energy to do it again. You know.
Both King and Allie Zirkle will take home a portion of this year's $600,000 purse, which is split among the top 30 finishers. More than $50,000 of it goes to winner Mitch Seavey. Seavey also wins a brand new Dodge Ram pickup truck. At the end of the Iditarod Trail in Nome, I'm Emily Schwing.
The Tanana Chiefs Conference annual convention is happening in Fairbanks this week. Yesterday, delegates heard from four interior men the organization believes were wrongly convicted of murder. The men, known as the Fairbanks Four, George Freeze, Kevin Pease, Marvin Roberts, and Eugene Vent, are serving long prison sentences for the 1997 beating death of teenager John Hartman in downtown Fairbanks. It's a case that's long drawn questions. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Many are suspect about the Fairbanks Four convictions because the men were heavily intoxicated the night the murder occurred, and there's no physical evidence tying them to the brutal crime, as well as allegations of racism and how the young defendants were treated. The Tanana Chiefs Conference has stepped up efforts to get new information in the case in recent years with a reward fund. TCC Justice Task Force Chair Shirley Lee says the Fairbanks Four connected with convention delegates Tuesday from prison via video and audio conference.
It was a chance for the boys to say thank you for all the efforts everyone's been doing on their behalf.
So it meant a lot to them.
The Alaska Innocence Project has been working the Fairbanks 4 case for several years, trying to pry loose new information and challenge the convictions. Director Bill Oberle, who also spoke to TCC delegates, says progress has been slow.
Back in October, I thought we would have filed by now. But we've run into some dead ends that I thought were going to develop. So we have to keep digging. And again, you know, 15 years, memories fade. It's difficult.
A friend of the four convicted men, Edgar Henry, says he has faith they'll be freed because he knows they're innocent. He says he was out partying with them the night of the Hartman murder.
But because everybody was so drunk that night, you know, we can't remember really, you know, what happened. You know, but we know that, you know, we were all together, you know, at this parties.
Another Fairbanks 4 supporter, Sky Malamute, was a young girl in 1997, but says she remembers seeing one of the men, Marvin Roberts, at her uncle's downtown wedding reception.
I wasn't old enough to stay out, of course, but I had seen him early in the night with my cousin, Daniel. And, you know, so there's no way that he could have done this because he was at the hall with everyone.
Malamute credits the Free the Fairbanks 4 effort, including a blog with educating people about the case. Organizer April Monroe Frick had mixed feelings following yesterday's video conference.
It's good to see them. It's powerful to see them. It's always very humbling to hear them talk about the impact the support has on keeping them going. But it's sad. It's not as things should be.
The ultimate goal of the Free the Fairbanks 4 effort is a declaration of innocence or a new trial for the four men who are now in their 30s. Monroe Frick reports raising $6,500 for the legal effort following Tuesday's conference calls and presentations at the TCC convention. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Alaska Senate has unanimously passed a bill that sets up financing for a North Slope to Fairbanks natural gas trucking project. Senate Bill 23 authorizes the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to provide financing to private industry. The legislation includes a $50 million grant, $30 million in tax credits, and more than $275 million in loans and bonds. The goal of the gas trucking project is to reduce the cost of energy in Fairbanks by 50% when compared to fuel oil, and get cheaper propane to remote areas. Fairbanks Senator Pete Kelly says the cost-benefit analysis is unprecedented.
The Ledge Finance Director came and went through the cost-benefit analysis with us, and he said this is an interesting project in that when they normally do the benefit-cost analysis, they're struggling to get to a ratio of 1. 1.1 is good. This is, from his analysis, rough analysis, a 3.5 cost-benefit ratio because it affects so many Alaskans.
Kelly said any loans to project developers from ADA will be paid back to the state by ratepayers. Another Fairbanks area senator, Click Bishop, stressed the urgency of doing something to lower the cost of energy and reduce polluting wood and coal burning in the Fairbanks area.
We have young children and elders that have respiratory problems, and this will hopefully help mitigate, clean up, and eliminate our PM2.5 air quality problem in Fairbanks.
Anchorage Senator Liesl McGuire added support from outside Fairbanks, saying that even if a future gas pipeline makes trucking obsolete, associated trucking infrastructure like a North Slope gas conditioning plant will remain useful. Senator Hollis French of Anchorage expressed general agreement, but urged scrutiny before any big spending.
$355 million of state money. I like to break large numbers down into high schools. Costs about $60 million to build a brand new high school. So I see six brand new high schools sort of at risk here for at least from the state side.
Senator French said the state has made bad investments in the past and said that it should only move ahead if it has a private industry partner with expertise in the field, something he doesn't see right now.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. It's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give, and good things will happen for the causes you care about. Learn more at pickclickgive.org.
This message sponsored by the Atwood Foundation, Flint Hills Resources, and Providence, Alaska.
The Anchorage Assembly has passed an ordinance allowing Anchorage bars to stay open an hour later, but they won't be able to serve alcohol during that extra hour. The ordinance is aimed at reducing problems in the downtown area at closing time. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Assemblymember Patrick Flynn first proposed an ordinance to address the problems associated with patrons crowding onto the street at closing time back in December. He was pushing for downtown bars to stop serving alcohol an hour earlier, at 2 a.m. rather than 3, hoping it would allow people to filter out instead of flood onto the streets. Some bar owners didn't like that idea, saying it was punitive because it just applied to downtown bars. So Assembly members Dick Traney and Adam Trombley proposed a new version, which was approved. Flynn explains.
What was approved was a little bit different in that it didn't change the hours of service and it maintained the hours of consumption, but it did allow bars to stay open for one extra hour if they opt in, and it's citywide as opposed to downtown specific. But it does retain the restriction that all consumption has to be concluded by 3 o'clock, and it's only on Fridays and Saturdays.
Sylvia Villamides is the director of Anchorage Char, the Cabaret Hotel Restaurant and Retailers Association. She testified before the assembly about the ordinance. She says allowing bars to stay open for the extra hour will make Anchorage safer.
This safety hour is for our patrons to have a place safe to wait for a ride home or a taxi cab. You won't have the influx of people leaving all at one time.
The ordinance is citywide. It was adopted on a trial basis and sunsets in 1 year. Bars will have to apply for a permit to stay open the extra hour. It will cost $100. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
A Dillingham couple has set the record for having built the world's most airtight house. Earlier this week, Tom Marsick and Kristen Donaldson received certification that their house goes on the books as the tightest on the planet.
We are certainly excited about that. The purpose of this world record was to help bring attention to energy efficiency and hopefully motivate others to be energy efficient, especially in the era of energy efficient buildings. And so by making it official, I think it's really helping emphasize that message.
The record was officially certified through the World Record Academy as tightest residential building. The airtightness was measured through a standard blower door test used in most energy audits. Marsick and Donaldson started building their super efficient home in 2010, modeled after a passive building designed at the UAF Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham. Alaskans and conservationists worldwide are mourning the passing of Ginny Wood, who died Friday at age 95. A memorial service will be held early next month for the Alaskan pioneer, aviator, world traveler, and environmentalist. KUAC's Tim Ellis has this remembrance.
The many tributes that have been written about Ginny Wood routinely include a long list of her many adventures and accomplishments, usually with such descriptors as Alaskan pioneer, aviator, naturalist, and, of course, environmentalist. Longtime friend and fellow traveler Susan Grace says good luck to those trying to summarize a life as fully lived as Wood's.
It's really impossible to sum up Ginny Wood.
Karen Brewster has done about as good a job as anyone in defining Wood's life. Brewster is an oral history researcher with UAF's Rasmussen Library who spent 2 years chronicling Wood's life and recounting it in a book released last spring. Boots, Bikes, and Bombers, Adventures of Alaska Conservationist Ginny Hill Wood recounts how the farm girl from Oregon first came to Alaska on January 1, 1947, with her fellow female flyer and friend Celia Hunter, both of whom were piloting surplus military aircraft like those they flew during World War II while serving in the Women's Auxiliary Flying Corps.
So they said, oh, well, you know, this would be a great adventure. We'll get to see Alaska. You know, we'll spend a few days flying up and hang out for a few days and, you know, take a commercial flight back. Well, it took them a month.
It took that long for the 60 below cold snap in Fairbanks to break, but by then Wood and Hunter had both been hired to fly supplies to the bush. They both found the last frontier to their liking, and the rest, as they say, is history. In 1951, Wood and her husband built Camp Denali, a guest lodge on their homestead just outside the Big Mountains National Park. Her love of wilderness grew over the next several decades as she flew, hiked, kayaked, floated, and guided tours throughout the state, until Brewster says the years finally caught up with her, forcing her to slow down.
By around 90, late 80s, 90 is when she was slowing down on doing that. She stopped, she skied until her mid-80s.
Throughout it all, Wood's love of wilderness grew, moving her to lead and join causes to protect it. Wood was among the first to call for preservation of the area now known as the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, beginning in earnest with her testimony in 1958 in a congressional subcommittee hearing in Fairbanks presided over by Senator Bob Bartlett. In 1960, Wood helped found the Alaska Conservation Society, the state's first environmental organization, formed to oppose Project Chariot, a Cold War-driven proposal to use nuclear weapons to blast and gouge out a harbor in northwestern Alaska. Inspired by the likes of Aldo Leopold and H.D. Thoreau, Wood worked tirelessly to conserve Alaska's wild places and, Brewster says, in turn inspired a new generation of environmental-minded Alaskans. Despite all that Wood accomplished, Grace says she remained humble.
About who she was and what she did. It was just what you do. It was just who she was.
In her final few years, Grace said Wood stayed close to home, welcoming friends to her little cabin in Fairbanks and tending her garden. Grace, a local singer-songwriter who was with Wood when she passed away, says that's how she'll remember her dear friend and how she'd sum up the life of Ginny Wood.
I would walk down the trail to her house, and I would look out in the garden first. Often she would be on her hands and knees with her rain pants on and her sun hat on and turning the entire garden with a hand trowel. And she'd look up, she'd have some smudge of dirt on her face, and she'd have this grin that was as wide as the Tanana Valley. And it was just the most wonderful thing.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Nome, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast is open for business with courses in accounting, information systems, and public administration. Degree programs and courses available online. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast.
The Kinnickarm Crossing would connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.